Metcast, Monday, January 23rd, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast, actually to the 600th episode of the MacCast. I just noticed the episode number on this is 600. We have been doing this a little while, haven't we? I actually also did a little math, quick math too. I think when I started the show, it was actually a pretty brief show. I think I was trying to keep them around 10, 15 minutes. They've obviously slowly morphed into something longer. If you've been a listener to the show for a while, you know most episodes run between an hour to an hour and a half. So I kind of did a little quick estimating and decided if the average show length ends up being about an hour, that's over 25 days of MacCast episodes. I guess if you listened to everyone starting with episode one all the way through this one back to back, I don't recommend doing that. That's probably crazy, but it's kind of amazing to think about that there is that much of me just talking into a microphone out there. A little mind-blowing when I really think about it. So anyway, how are you doing? I am doing good. Have a good episode lined up for you. Should be a lot of fun. We have a lot of things to talk about. We have AirPods and some more information on how the magic behind them probably works. Foxconn may be looking to do some more manufacturing here in the States. We'll talk a little bit about that. Apple making some changes to Apple TV apps for the better, I think. Also, what's happening with next generation iPhone rumors, some information about Apple Music maybe moving beyond music a little bit, got MacBook Pro rumors, Qualcomm and Apple at odds over some licensing stuff, and what's happening maybe with the next iPads and Apple Pencil, plus some software updates to get into. That, along with your feedback, we're going to follow up a little bit on flash storage. I had made some comments on the last episode about that, and a lot of you chimed in and had some great comments to make there. Got a question about what to do with network backups when the time capsule maybe goes away. So we'll get into that a little bit. Some tips on Apple Messages. And I have a great thing of the moment this episode for you. It's been a little while since we've done those. So should be a lot of fun. Stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Blue Apron. You know, Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And I have to tell you, I've been enjoying Blue Apron for the past couple of weeks, and it is awesome. What I particularly love about it is we have a challenge in my family of trying to figure out what we want to have to eat every week. It is a constant battle. It is a struggle. We have some picky eaters in the house, I have to admit. And Blue Apron has been great for that because each week they come out with a set of new recipes. So once you're on the service, you go, you pick what you want, and it's all great, delicious stuff. But what I love about it is there's a variety and it's all great. It's shipped to you. It comes fresh. So like once you've picked your meals, and that's really easy to do. One, it's really easy to sign up. Two, it's really easy to go in there and find the meals that you want, find the stuff that you like, pick what you want, get that all set up, and you can schedule to have that delivered whenever fits best into your schedule. So what happens is they give you all of the ingredients, everything you need to make these delicious meals, and they ship it to your house for that week. And then once you get it, it comes packaged beautifully. Everything is fresh. It's locally sourced. It's really good quality. And then you take it all out. When you're ready to make it, they give you these great, easy-to-follow recipes. And another thing that we've loved about it is having the recipes. We found some great new meals now that we can work into our meal plan. So we all struggle with this, right? You get tired of kind of having the same things over and over again. So here's a chance to have a service that's going to let you explore new menus, explore new flavors. We've found just new tastes and spices and things that we're going to start incorporating into other things, all because of having Blue Apron. It has just been great, and the meals were all delicious. We haven't had a thing yet that we haven't liked. As a matter of fact, this past week, I probably had the meal that I liked the most so far. It was this great Italian version of a meatloaf with a toasted pasta and cauliflower side dish. Absolutely delicious. We're definitely going to be baking that one again. And we can because we have the recipe right there. We have all the ingredients. And again, kind of keeping with this theme of not getting bored, what's great about Blue Apron is they don't repeat recipes each week. So every week you're going to get a new batch of recipes, new flavors, new things to try out. And it all comes, you know, all the ingredients you need, pre-portioned. And so convenience is another great part of it. Makes it easier to have a good home-cooked meal rather than just, you know, falling back on going out to eat, right? You can get everybody around the table, have a great meal, great conversation, really great way to bring families back together. So we're enjoying that part of it as well. And best of all, because you're a MacCast listener, you can try out Blue Apron for free. You can check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free along with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/MacCast. And you will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/MacCast to get your free meals. And a big thank you to Blue Apron for their support of the MacCast. If you saw Apple's announcement of their AirPods, if you saw that keynote and you saw the pairing process that the new AirPods do with iOS, you know that it's like magical. If you've had a chance to try it out for yourself, it's really an amazing thing. And it really kind of changes how you connect with Bluetooth devices, right? It's always been kind of this hassle, a little bit of a hassle, not a big one, but a hassle pairing and keeping Bluetooth things paired. And Apple kind of tackled that problem with the new AirPods, but no one really knew how it was done. Apple said, you know, we've got this new W1 chip. Obviously, there's some things going on in software, but really, we didn't know how the magic was created. Well, this week, actually, we got an opportunity to kind of find out how Apple is doing it, because Apple, or the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, rather, published the application that describes exactly how AirPods work in terms of the pairing. Now, as you may expect, the key is the charging case, which actually also acts as a physical Bluetooth pairing interface. So, you know, typically we're used to like pressing that button or pressing a button on a Bluetooth device, going through some sort of pairing process where we've got to enter sometimes a security code, right? It's this cumbersome thing. Well, the AirPod charging case actually has its own microprocessor, its own communication stack and security and all that stuff is built in, and it's triggered, the process is triggered by motion sensors in the lid. That's why when you open the lid to pair it with your iOS device for the first time, the iOS device automatically starts communicating and connects. Now, inside the AirPods themselves, there's also actually a tiny memory module that stores that linked information. So once they're paired, they're going to stay paired. You know that, or you may have heard that if you're using your iCloud account, that information can actually be synced. So once you've paired with one device, it will be automatically paired with all of your other devices. So that's kind of how Apple tackled that problem. So this great combination, and it's really what Apple does really well, right? This great combination of hardware and software and integration, because they control all the endpoints, they can actually do that. And there's also actually some magic in the communication of the AirPods with the paired device that is described in the patent as well, that goes beyond just the pairing process. What happens is once you're paired, one AirPod is actually set up as the primary device that's communicating with your host device, so be it your iPhone or your iPad, whatever that might be. And then that primary AirPod is actually sending data and audio signals to the second AirPod. But here's where it gets pretty neat. When you remove the primary AirPod from your ear, the secondary AirPod automatically switches over and becomes the primary AirPod. So it's all totally seamless. You can pop them in and out, change them around, use one, use the other. It's just this really sort of magical experience. And it sounds so silly, you know, talking that way about something as simple as like headphones, especially headphones from Apple, right? These are basically EarPods made wireless. But the way Apple has done this, and I've said this in a couple other episodes, it really is amazing. And I'm hoping to see more of this kind of product focus from Apple in the next year, because this is really what they excel at, what they're great at. And it seems to be working. We talked a little bit last time about data from Slice Intelligence that showed that Apple's AirPods over the holiday season captured a large portion of the market, sales market for wireless headphones. If you remember Slice, what they actually do is they look at email receipts of 4.2 million shoppers, and they use those receipts to determine what they're buying and sort of break that down into sales numbers. And they did this in December and found that AirPods had 26% of the sales, and Beats got 15%, but that was actually down from 24%. So the assumption with the Slice data was that AirPods were kind of eating into some of the other wireless headphone markets and actually capturing a good portion of sales, at least in December. Well, NPD Group came out and said that the Slice data, you know, AirPods are doing well, but the Slice data doesn't really tell the whole story. And NPD, their data is a little bit different. They do a weekly retail tracking, and they use not just online data and email receipts, but they also look at brick and mortar data. And they say that the last week they put the report out for that Apple got about 2% of the unit sales of the wireless headphone market and about 3% of the dollars. And that Beats actually had 25% of unit sales and 46% of the dollars. So, you know, Beats, according to the NPD data, is still vastly outselling the AirPods in terms of unit quantity and percentage of the dollars. But they also note, you know, that doesn't mean that the AirPods aren't doing well. With just 2% of the market within just a couple weeks of sales, Apple's impact is really significant. And the NPD data sort of backs up the Slice data, at least in that regard. And kind of to put that in perspective, you know, 2% of the market sounds tiny, but Jaybirds, a well-established wireless headphone brand, has also had 2% share also in the same study or the same report from NPD Group. So Apple AirPods moving up very, very quickly. And this is just one product that's only been on sale for a few weeks. So, and just based on the reviews and things like that, we can expect that kind of sales trend to continue. So doing very well. AirPods overall have been getting great reviews, although there have been some people recently reporting a few issues, and Apple is supposedly looking into some problems that some users say AirPods have been dropping audio, mostly on telephone calls for them. There is a discussion forum thread going on Apple's support website where a lot of people are commenting on these issues. If you look at the trends, it's looking like a majority of the people having problems seem to be on iPhone 6S or 6S Plus models, although there are some people noting issues on iPhone 7s, iPhone 7 Plus, so that's not a definitive thing. The issues do seem to be mostly restricted to the AirPods dropping out during phone calls. There's kind of a range, although a lot of them seem to be longer phone calls, so once an hour or something like that. Some people are reporting the issue more frequently, so it's hard to tell really what's going on or what the consistent sort of common thread is, but Apple is supposedly looking into it. If you have run into issues, and there may be some overlap here, so what might be happening is there could be a common thread, but that's being muddied a little bit by some people having just extraneous problems. I had a few issues with my AirPods and was able to kind of resolve them by doing an AirPod reset. And in case you missed my discussion, I think last time or the time before, on how to do that, what you do is you just take both AirPods, you put them in the case, then you press and hold the pairing button on the back. So flip open the case so you can see the little light. Press and hold the pairing button on the back and hold that down about 15 to 20 seconds. What you're going to wait for is until you see the little light, the pairing light, go from white to amber and then flash three times. And then it'll kind of drop back into the standard pairing mode. And then you're going to want to go into whatever device you have it paired with at the time. Go into the settings, Bluetooth, click the little info icon, and tell the device to forget the AirPods. Then you can close it up, open the lid on the charging case again, and just repair the AirPods. You've basically done a factory reset, so you're going to start the pairing process all over again. And like I said earlier, if you're syncing with iCloud, that pairing should sync to all of your other devices. If not, go ahead and just repair with every other device that you need to, kind of following the same procedure where you tell it to forget the old AirPods and reconnect. And that should clear up a number of issues. I was having the kind of battery case charging issue, and that seemed to resolve that problem. So try that. But if you have been experiencing dropouts, know that you're not alone, and Apple is reportedly looking into that. There have been a lot of rumors and speculation flying around recently, and we've talked about it a little bit on this show, of Apple and possibly some of their manufacturing partners moving some production to the United States. And this week we had a report from Nikkei out of Japan that claims a Sharp executive said, yeah, they're possibly looking into an LCD plant in the U.S. There's still plans on the table. If you remember, Apple's main manufacturing partner, Foxconn, acquired Sharp LCD. So there's now kind of this tie-in and connection to Apple. The first reports of a possible U.S. investment in a plant actually came from Foxconn investment partner, SoftBank. We reported on this a couple weeks back, I think. They were doing a presentation. They had made an announcement that they were going to create a $50 billion investment fund in the U.S. aimed at generating 50,000 new jobs and opening up new factories and manufacturing facilities, plants, basically making this fund available to companies who would want to come into the U.S. And as part of that announcement, there was kind of a leak. I think it was a leak. It was like a screenshot or something from the presentation that showed that Foxconn would be making a $7 billion investment in the U.S. through the kind of SoftBank fund. Now, Foxconn CEO had confirmed that, yeah, they had discussions about all of this with SoftBank, but that they really had not made any firm commitment. So at this point, he was kind of saying, it's just all in the discussion phase. It's something we're considering, but we really haven't committed. And a lot of this discussion and these things are being predicated on the fact that President Trump has made promises of tax incentives to companies if they will come into the U.S. and open up manufacturing. But still, even if, and this is a big if, Sharp does decide to go forward and, you know, build or construct an LCD plant here in the U.S., this latest report makes it sound like it's probably more for the purpose of producing LCD panels for televisions and maybe monitors and not necessarily for the iPhone. And so we had that report kind of come out earlier in the week, and then late this week, and a possibly separate or maybe possibly related rumor, once again, Nikkei journalists were at Foxconn's annual end of the year party. And they got some statements from the Foxconn chairman, Terry Gao, and he claimed that this time Apple is interested in investing with them to set up a display plant in the U.S. Now, some of the details were a little bit different. Some of the dollar figures were a little bit different. So I don't know if we're talking about the same thing here, but the report claims that Foxconn may actually be looking to do a few different plants. One plant that was mentioned was a molding facility, possibly in the state of Pennsylvania, but the other one would be more related to maybe Apple's business is Foxconn possibly moving one of their Canadian display companies, Smart Technologies. This is a startup that they acquired, moving that from Canada down to the U.S. And as to why they would do that, Glau explained that there's been growing demand for bigger display panels and that U.S. production would actually be a better option than importing parts from China. And he commented part of the reason for this is the growing concern over the U.S. protectionism that may happen under the Trump administration. So he sort of was commenting on the fact that that was factoring in or would potentially factor into the decision on whether or not they would move the plant from Canada to the U.S. And he warned that actually to make that happen, what they would need is some significant concessions, specifically on land costs and costs of electricity, in order to avoid potential huge price increases on parts produced in the U.S. that would then be probably passed on to consumers. So it felt a little bit like he was kind of doing a little bit of political posturing and kind of making a case for, we know Foxconn's been looking at potentially doing some more production in the U.S. So it's kind of, you know, they're setting up they're putting their ducks in a row, right? They're lining things up to try and make this happen. And it's obvious that what they're going to be looking for from the United States is some big discounts in terms of land and power. And if you're wondering why that might be, most of the reports that I've read have said, yes, they're going to try and create some new jobs. Their plants could eventually create 30 to 50,000 new jobs here in the U.S., but also that most of their plants would be highly automated. We would have a lot more robot workers. And we talked, I think, a little bit about the Foxconn robots. So obviously robots are going to require more power. If they can get a great deal on power, that's going to bring their costs down and make the possibility of actually producing things here in the U.S. a little more viable. Will it happen or not? Who knows? You know, time is going to tell, and there's a lot of factors that are going to have to go into this change. But we've talked a little bit about some of the growing challenges that are happening in China, and a lot of companies are looking to move from China to other locations. And the U.S. at this point is not out of the realm of possibility. I think that's what's kind of exciting about this story. But as I've also mentioned, it's not just China that companies are looking to expand into. And we also got a report this week that Apple also plans to expand iPhone production into India. Actually, this is a story that's been happening for a while as well. It's gone back and forth. Part of the genesis of it was that Apple wants to open retail stores in India. They want to be able to sell iPhones through their own retail stores. And in India, they have to have at least 30% of their products sourced locally in order to get into the retail business there. It's just part of the rules. And Apple has been trying to work with the Indian government to get some concessions on maybe building a factory there. And they were reportedly working with Foxconn to try and get that done, to try and get it open. Well, this week we got more recent reports that say Apple has actually selected a new manufacturing partner that's already in the region. This is Wistron. And you may recognize that name because a while back it was rumored, I think last year, that Apple was going to use Wistron as a second supplier for the iPhone SE and the iPhone 7 Plus to kind of make up for high demand and try and make up the difference where Foxconn couldn't kind of fulfill orders fast enough. I don't remember hearing if that happened or not, but this time around, the report is that Wistron could get a contract to manufacture iPhones in India. And that would solve a couple of Apple's problems. One, it would give them that ability to source components out of India and potentially get those retail stores opened. But it would also allow them, I think, to get into India with manufacturing quicker than actually building a plant. And I think the last advantage for Apple is it adds a third iPhone manufacturing partner, which means more capacity to build iPhones, and everything is indicating that this year iPhone demand is going to be particularly strong since it's the 10th anniversary and we're expected to have some major technology changes with the iPhone. So more capacity to kind of meet that demand, and it would also mean less reliance on just Foxconn and Pegatron, Apple's two current manufacturing partners, meaning they can kind of pit those companies against each other to get the best deal and best production and spread things out a little bit more. So I think it's good all the way around, and it's sounding like it's likely to happen this year. And then, you know, finally, just in general, this is something interesting to think about. Anytime Apple, you know, regardless of where their plants are, US, China, India, Brazil, whatever might be happening, every year when Apple has a new iPhone coming out, their competitors have to start to scramble for components. It's not really anything new, but Apple beginning to ramp up production. We're starting to feel and hear report or starting to hear reports about, and Apple's competitors are feeling the constraints in the supply chain for everything, all kinds of components, LCD panels, RAM, storage, cameras, sensors, all of those things become harder to come by. And in particular this year, one of the areas I think that's going to feel a big constraint is OLED displays. And that's because Apple wants at least their flagship iPhone 8 to use an OLED display, according to rumors. And this is going to be the first time that Apple has done that. And while OLEDs have a number of advantages for Apple, like being brighter and using less energy, they are harder to build and generally have lower yield rates. So Apple, with their insatiable demands for displays, you can expect is going to have a big impact on the OLED market. So I'm bringing this up only to point out that it's something we'll kind of watch, we'll keep an eye on. But I have a feeling you'll start to see some of Apple's competitors kind of move things around to try and get around Apple's sort of buying up all of the components that they need to make smartphones this year. So I think just today we started hearing reports that Samsung might possibly delay the next Galaxy phone. Now, it's probably more related to some of the battery issues that they've been having. They just came out with a report on, you know, what they discovered in that investigation. And I think they're just being cautious in that arena. But it could also be, and I would imagine, component supplies and the ability to get component supplies like OLED displays would also factor into that sort of timing and decision on, hey, when are we actually going to release products? And Apple certainly has an impact and has for a long time in that area. Good news for developers of Apple TV apps this week, and actually for those of us who enjoy using those apps, especially, I think, games on the Apple TV. Apple last week raised the data cap size on Apple TV apps from just 200 megabytes to 4 gigabytes. And you may or may not remember this, but when Apple announced apps for the Apple TV, one of the things that they did to keep file sizes down so you didn't eat up all the limited storage on the Apple TV was to tell developers you can only have your app install 200 megabytes or use up 200 megabytes of local storage. If you need more data and assets, you have to store those in the cloud and pull those down on demand. Well, that created some pretty big constraints for larger titles, say like 3D first-person shooter games or anything that used heavy graphics or heavy media, even like video apps and things like that. The ability to kind of cache and store stuff was somewhat limited. So now we're hearing that this is going to be raised significantly to 4 gigabytes. It will allow developers to preload much more content, store a lot more data locally, and that can really help speed up performance and load times, I think, for graphic intensive and media heavy apps. Now, developers still also get 20 gigabytes of hosted assets on the Apple Store, and those can be downloaded on demand. But this is going to make things a lot better. The 200 megabytes always seemed to me a little restrictive, especially given the fact that the fourth generation Apple TV, its base size is 32 gigabytes. And of course, you can get 64 gigabytes. I guess now that the size limits are lifted, you have actually more of a reason to probably opt for buying a 64 gigabyte model. You may remember that one of the dilemmas was, well, hey, if apps are only allowed to use 200 megabytes, why do I actually need a 64 gigabyte Apple TV? And this could be a reason why. Another speculation as to why Apple is maybe increasing the size limits is it's a move in preparation of making more 4K content available from streaming services and maybe even from iTunes itself. Obviously, if we get into 4K streaming and 4K video and you're wanting to cache that stuff, it's going to eat up more storage. So many expect that the next Apple TV, when and if we get one, may possibly bring 4K video support. And so some good news for, I think, Apple TV apps. We should see some cool new things happening now that that size limit. I would expect more games and more probably console-level games making their way to the Apple TV, and I'm kind of actually excited about that. One group of you who may not be as excited about buying new Apple TV apps is those of you in the UK. Apparently this week things have become, in terms of apps at least, have become a little bit more expensive for you because of the fluctuating exchange rates. It came out this week that Apple was raising the base prices of apps and in-app purchases in the UK by more than 25%. So an app that recently could have been purchased for, say, 79p is now going to be 99p. And basically what's happening is you're now at dollar equivalents in the UK with US prices at the various tiers. So if it's $1.99 in the US, it's going to be £1.99 in the UK. Now, the one thing to remember is that UK prices still include a 20% value-added tax in the price. So that's part of it, but also just the exchange rate because of Brexit and all of those sorts of things. That's having an impact. And Apple does this frequently. I think pricing also this past week went up in Turkey as well. So nothing unusual, but that is happening. And one other thing that's somewhat TV-related, more specifically with the new TV app, and I talked last week, we're going to follow up a little bit on that, about, you know, my thoughts on the TV app and the fact that it didn't have support for Netflix, I think, is a big detriment for Apple. And I'm hoping that they're going to work with Netflix and try and get that further integrated. Well, there was a small light of hope this week when I started seeing reports saying, hey, Netflix support is in Apple TV. Got all excited, and when I started digging into the stories, what I realized was, yeah, they added some new support for Netflix, but definitely not Netflix integration with the TV app. So what's happening now, in case you saw this story and didn't have a chance to look into it further, if you search for a movie or TV show inside the TV app, or if you browse to it, and it is available for streaming in Netflix, and it's also something that can be purchased through iTunes, you will now see a Play in Netflix option. And when you click on that or tap on that, just like with the other TV app supported services, it will automatically open and start playing that show or movie right in the Netflix app. So that's pretty cool. It works the same as, you know, Hulu or HBO Go or any other thing that you might find inside the TV app. Unfortunately, that's where the new support and functionality for Netflix stops. Shows that you watch in Netflix will not appear in the Watch Now tab. They will not be factored into any of the recommendations that you get. And because only Netflix content that is also available in iTunes works with this feature, it means that original Netflix shows like Stranger Things, those don't get the Play in Netflix button. You actually can click on the little ellipses button and choose the Open in Netflix option on those entries, but that just jumps you to that item in the Netflix app. It doesn't automatically start playing that episode. So that's kind of the distinction. I know it's a little bit tricky to think about, but the point is, again, it's not full integration. And one last thing that you can do, again, you can add any content that's available for streaming on Netflix and also available for sale in iTunes to the Up Next portion of the Watch Now. So you can actually get that content into your list, but you have to kind of do it manually, and it's only for a limited set of content. So hopefully I explained that in a way that's not too confusing. Probably the best way to understand it is to actually go into the TV app and play around with this if you're a Netflix subscriber. So check it out. Let me know what you think, but it's a far cry from, I think, where the integration needs to be at this point. if you know anything about the waterproofing on the current generation of the iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus, you probably know that Apple has made it pretty water resistant. It's pretty waterproof. Well, guess what? The next generation iPhone we're hearing is going to be even more waterproofier. Yes, that's a real word. No, it really isn't. I just made it up. According to sources who spoke with the Korea Herald, the next iPhone will up its water and dust rating to IP68. That's up from the IP67 rating on the iPhone. And at this point, you're probably like me and saying, I have no idea what IP68 or 67 even means. Well, what that means is that the iPhone 8 should be able to survive being submerged in up to 1.5 meters of water for up to 30 minutes. And before you get too excited, like I said, it just means that that phone can now live in 0.5 meters of more water for the same time as the iPhone 7. So it can go a little bit deeper. And to be quite honest, I wouldn't test this myself, but some people have been testing the iPhone 7, and the iPhone 7 has actually survived longer than that rating. So I think the IP68, 67 ratings, those are just done under lab tests. They confirm, yeah, they're going to at least survive this much. They can potentially go even longer and survive even better underwater. But we're hearing Apple is going to continue to improve that spec, at least just a little bit more. Yes, more waterproofier on the iPhone 8. Again, we also continue to hear other reports about what's going to happen with the next generation iPhone, including this continued report of a three-tier iPhone launch. Most people are in agreement at this point that we're going to see a 4.7-inch model and a 5.5-inch model, the design looking pretty close to the same, if not exactly the same, as the current iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus. Some people have even referred to these models as the 7S and the 7S Plus, though most people believe Apple will jump straight to iPhone 8. But we'll have the two existing designs and then an all-new 5.8-inch design that's supposed to have this OLED wraparound all-glass design, wireless charging, integrated home button, and Touch ID sensor, everything kind of built into the screen, what is being referred to as the Johnny Ive glass sandwich, right? We've talked about all of this stuff. So why am I bringing this all up, and why are we rehashing it? Well, this week, Timothy Akuri of Cowen and Company put out a research note and added some updated and kind of new rumors or things we hadn't heard before to this rumor mill. He said that Apple may actually choose and still hasn't ruled out the possibility of going with an OLED display in all three models, the 4.7 and 5.5-inch model, if they can get the supply that they need. Remember what we were talking about earlier with Apple kind of scooping up all the OLED panels? If they do it across the line, wow, there's going to be an extreme shortage of OLED displays. But most reports still have kind of said Apple will stick with the IPS displays, standard LCDs, in the 4.7, 5.5-inch updated models and only go with the flexible OLED on that flagship phone. Apple is also possibly switching the Touch ID sensor because they would have to build it into the display. They wouldn't be able to use the little metal ring technology, capacitive technology, I think, that they currently use. So Timothy Akuri thinks that Apple may switch to a technology from a company called Synaptech. They have an optical-based fingerprint reader that could actually live under the screen. Now, this is a little bit questionable because it's not clear if the Synaptech technology is actually ready to go or if it could even be produced at the quantity levels that Apple would need. But they would need to come up with some other technology that would be able to make that Touch ID sensor work through the glass and through the layers of the display. So that's one possibility. Another thing that Akuri mentioned is that Apple may be possibly adding facial and gesture recognition technology, at least to the high-end phone. And this is something that analyst Ming-Chi Kuo also believes Apple may be looking to do. He's commented on Apple adding facial recognition to the biometrics on the next generation iPhone. So One of the rumors that's being thrown around is maybe Apple dumps the Touch ID sensor altogether and goes with a pure facial recognition, or there may be some combination of the two technologies for the biometrics. I kind of have mixed feelings about that. I like the Touch ID sensor. I think it's a fast, convenient, secure way for unlocking the phone. And to me, the idea of holding up my phone to my face every time I want to open it up seems a little bit odd. I guess if they can get it working in a way where the angles don't factor in too much, where it doesn't have to be straight on, where it can kind of detect even when it's laying on a table that I'm the person nearby and it just magically unlocks, that could work for me. But I don't know how exactly the technology will work. And that's just the biometric part. There's also these rumors of facial and gesture recognition, you know, being able to swipe through my phone without actually touching the screen. Other facial recognition things could come into play, I guess, if Apple really is going to use the iPhone to move into an augmented reality or virtual reality experience. Apple might want to have those technologies in there for that. We've heard about Apple maybe doing some goggles or some sort of display that integrates or plays off of the iPhone screen, whether it's, you know, docking into something. That's more of a virtual reality experience. And Tim Cook has said Apple is more interested in augmented reality. So I always pictured it as being some sort of glasses or something that would connect either via wirelessly, somewhat sort of wireless technology that you would wear, where your iPhone is sort of the driving force. And I don't know that would necessarily require the iPhone to have built-in facial recognition or gesture recognition. But maybe the two things play together in some way, and this is Apple just sort of building in the technologies they need for future developments. Who really knows? Finally, with respect to updates to iOS and iPhone, we're hearing a somewhat sketchy report about iOS 11 and possibly finally adding group calling into FaceTime. The reason I say this rumor's a little bit sketchy is it comes from an Israeli site we haven't heard of before, so they don't have really any kind of track record on rumors. It's called The Verifier. I would say logically it makes sense that Apple would do it, and if they did announce a feature like this, we would expect, I think, it to be announced at WWDC in June. But really my immediate reaction to this was, yes, let's add it. That is a great feature. It should be in there. It should have been in there a long, long time ago. I think we were talking about this on the iOS show, and Michael Johnston pointed out that, hey, remember when we had iChat AV? Yeah, that had multi-user group video calling built into it, and it went away when we got FaceTime. So why that hasn't been brought back in, who knows? So I'm hoping this rumor, even though it's a little sketchy at this point, does turn out to be true. We'll just have to wait and see until iOS 11 is announced in June. Despite what you might think by its name, Apple Music is not just about music, at least according to the folks running the show for Apple Music over there at Apple. Apple's music head, Jimmy Iovine, confirmed that Apple is looking at more than just music content for their Apple Music service. He says, quote, at Apple Music, we're trying to create an entire pop cultural experience, and that happens to also include audio and video. He specifically mentioned that they are looking for stuff that will, quote, hit pop culture smack on the nose. So that kind of confirms what we already knew to a little bit. You know, Apple's been working on other programming, Apple Music. They're trying to distinguish it from other streaming music services out there. And in another interview with Complex Magazine, some of the other heads of Apple Music, Zane Lowe, Bozma St. John, and Larry Jackson, made some similar kind of statements. As a matter of fact, Jackson made a statement that was almost exactly the same comment as Jimmy Iovine. He said, the goal is to make this service the intersection of all things pop culture. And really, the music service has kind of been doing this already. They've gone outside just music and music videos. If you remember, they recently had the exclusive rights to the 808 documentary about the Roland 808. They've aired already a couple video episodes in the Score documentary series, music documentary series, the Score Reservation Rap. That was through one of their content partners, Vice. We know that they purchased the streaming rights to James Corden's Carpool Karaoke, and that they're going to be airing those episodes via Apple Music. And they're also reportedly working on this semi-autobiographical TV series with Dr. Dre called Vital Signs. And we've heard about a show called Planet of the Apps, which I guess is this kind of American Idol style show, but for app developers. So they're going to have app developers come on and pitch ideas to a celebrity panel, which I think includes like Gwyneth Paltrow and Gary Vaynerchuk, among others, and try and get feedback and try and get, I think, funding or something to get their app made. We don't know a lot of details, but it's that kind of reality show that they're producing. And reportedly, all of this stuff is going to be going into Apple Music. And then more recently, we had these rumors, and I think we talked about these last time, that claimed Apple has been out talking to producers and directors about possibly doing more scripted TV shows, original movies, and original content for Apple, though at this point it's not clear if that would be something that would be integrated into the Apple Music service. The naming kind of makes me laugh a little bit. You know, I was joking about it earlier when I said Apple Music isn't just about music, despite its name, but isn't this the same sort of trap we fell into with iTunes? If Apple starts doing original video content and things like that and starts integrating it into Apple Music, is it really music anymore? It kind of starts to feel like MTV, right? Remember when MTV started out as just a music channel, but then morphed into more of a pop culture channel surrounding all forms of entertainment, TV, movies, music, and even reality TV at some point. And then it kind of just became all of that and less about the music. Hopefully that doesn't happen with Apple Music. But I think when you start to think about this, it actually makes sense that Apple would try and build a brand around just pop culture and that it would morph into something like that. And it would help actually Apple Music really distinguish itself from some of the other pure music competitors out there that they're competing against. And I would love more original content that is available through Apple Music. But at the same time, I worry a little bit about it being too much of a distraction for Apple. And I kind of think like they might be better off in either partnering. Some people have talked about them potentially buying a company like Netflix and just integrating that content into their services. I'd more like to see them just kind of partner with Netflix or Hulu and start to try and bring all of that together, all that content and those original shows and that programming together under the Apple Music brand and integrate it as part of the service so that I'm not having to pay little micropayments to a bunch of different services, but maybe can pull it all together. That's probably a pipe dream. It's probably not realistic. It's more just like what I'd like to see. So if Apple can get it out there and maybe produce some more great original shows like Amazon or Netflix and just integrate them into my Apple Music subscription, I guess I'd be happy with that too. But who really knows what's going on? What we do know is happening is that Apple is at least thinking about this, and some of the heads of Apple Music are now starting to talk about the fact that, yeah, we're looking beyond just a music service and we're looking at other forms of content and trying to integrate that into what we're doing here at Apple Music. Sort of confirming what's already been said in some other rumors, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo gave a note to his investors this past week that he sees Apple focusing on more internal updates for the MacBook Pro lineup in 2017. Specifically, he's saying Apple will switch to Intel's latest Kaby Lake architecture for an update of the MacBook Pro sometime in 2017. The change is going to be good because it's likely going to address one of the major complaints of the current model. Well, a couple of the major complaints of the current model. One, the fact that it's using older generation processors, so that gets taken care of. But also the fact that the current model MacBook Pro maxes out at 16 gigabytes of RAM. The new architecture would allow them to at least offer up to 32 gigabytes of RAM on the 15-inch models. And Kuo does make a note of that in his report. He also addresses what appeared to be the bad sales performance of Apple's new notebook. He says and notes that the latest numbers from Gartner showed an 8.7% decline in Mac shipments year over year, but says a big part of that was due to unforeseen production delays and that Apple has fixed those supply chain bottlenecks, and he does expect Apple to return to Mac growth in 2017. So he didn't see that as such a big issue or a detriment, and he thinks Apple will be back on track now that, I think, you know, he says unforeseen production delays. I think a big part of it was just the release cycle of the appropriate, you know, processors from Intel for new Apple models. I think it's why we didn't see new iMacs. We've kind of talked about all this stuff a little bit. So the fact that Apple now has new processors primed for Macs, and they're going to be able to do some significant new updates and things like that, that's going to help return them back to Mac growth in 2017. In addition, and kind of speaking of new MacBooks, in addition to updated MacBook Pros, other reports have indicated that Apple will update both the iMac and the MacBook lines in 2017. All of this, though, no specifics have been really given. It's believed that iMacs and MacBooks will be revealed with the latest Intel processors and new AMD GPUs, and probably standardize on the new USB-C connectors and Thunderbolt 3 ports, at least in the iMac for the Thunderbolt 3. It'll be interesting to see if they bring Thunderbolt 3 to the MacBook. I'm assuming they're probably going to leave that exclusive for the MacBook Pro models. But we should be getting some significant Mac updates. You know, the synopsis of all this is we should be getting finally some significant Mac updates here in 2017. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission this week filed a lawsuit against Qualcomm, accusing them of violating the FTC Act and, among other things, forcing Apple into an exclusive deal to buy their baseband chips from Qualcomm. In reading the report, the way I understand it is it seems that Apple had gone to Qualcomm looking for lower patent royalties. Qualcomm has a bunch of patents on technologies that Apple uses in its devices, specifically, I think, the iPhone and the iPad, and they were looking to pay lower royalties on those. And Qualcomm said, yeah, sure, we'll give you lower royalty rates, but if we do, you have to agree to buy our baseband chips, our cellular modem chips, exclusively for the iPhone from 2011 until 2016. And that's why in 2016, just this last year with the iPhone 7, supposedly we saw Apple finally using non-Qualcomm chips. If you remember, some of the iPhones actually are using baseband chips from Intel, and that's because this exclusivity agreement ran out. Well, I guess the FTC looked into this. They started investigating Qualcomm in 2014, and they said that they believed the company was abusing their fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, their FRAND patent commitments. And so the FTC has been investigating this since 2014, and this week decided, yep, we have enough evidence that we're going to go ahead and file a lawsuit. Interestingly, Qualcomm was also fined $853 million by the South Korean Fair Trade Commission for similar practices with some of their Korean partners. So it's not just the FTC alleging that Qualcomm's been behaving like this. The South Korean government also levied a fine against Qualcomm. Now, for its part, Qualcomm did issue a press release denying doing anything wrong and called the FTC's accusations, quote, significantly flawed. Qualcomm says the FTC actually lacks the basic information about the industry that they're regulating, and that they were relying on inaccurate information and presumptions. They feel that the FTC has been premature in actually filing this lawsuit. So obviously Qualcomm doesn't agree. They're going to be fighting it. And so all that happened earlier in the week, and then just days after the FTC announced its lawsuit, CNBC reported that Apple was suing Qualcomm for $1 billion in patent royalties. The suit claims that Qualcomm has actually held $1 billion in payments that were due to Apple as retaliation for Apple truthfully responding to queries from law enforcement in South Korea who were investigating Qualcomm. So apparently Apple was asked about some things related to the South Korean Fair Trade Commission's investigation. They answered those things, Apple says, truthfully, and that upset Qualcomm, and Qualcomm has then been holding back royalty payments to the tune of $1 billion that are due to Apple. Apple's suit also alleges that Qualcomm has, quote, unfairly insisted on charging royalties for technologies they have nothing to do with, and that, quote, Qualcomm insists on charging Apple at least five times more in payments than all the other cellular patent licensors we have agreements with combined. So they're saying Qualcomm's taking advantage of us, they're overcharging us, they're withholding royalties, and we're going to be suing them for $1 billion. Qualcomm says, for their part on this lawsuit, that they are reviewing the complaint and they feel that Apple's claims are, quote, baseless, and they look forward to the opportunity to have these meritless claims heard in court, where we will be entitled to the full discovery of Apple's practices and a robust examination of the merits. So a couple of lawsuits definitely going through, but things are looking a little grim for Qualcomm right now. They're being accused of some pretty serious stuff. So we'll have to see how this all plays out for them and Apple. We've been talking a little bit on past shows about new iPads maybe coming out this spring, a couple different models, and we'll get back and give you a little recap of those in a second. But there is a new report out from the Chinese microblogging site Weibo that says, along with the new iPads, we will also get an updated Apple Pencil, presumably the Apple Pencil 2. And you might be imagining, wow, the first Apple Pencil, that was amazing. What killer new features are we going to get in Apple Pencil 2? Magnets, people. We get magnets. Apparently, the killer new feature of the Apple Pencil 2 will be the ability to attach the pencil to your iPad's bezel using magnets when it is not in use, or some sort of magnetic latching mechanism. But wait, before you get too disappointed, there's more. They're also saying it will come with a standard pen clip so you can attach it to your body as well. And I'm talking about just a little spring clip on the outside of it. Yeah, like your standard ballpoint pen that would allow you to clip it to your pocket or clothing or something like that. Now, that's not the only thing. They're saying there also could be some new internal antenna technology in there. I don't know if that means it's going to be more reliable in terms of the connection. I've never really had any issues with mine other than when the battery dies. But that's supposedly, you know, the big new stuff that's going to be in the Apple Pencil 2, at least according to Weibo. You'd think it'd be somewhat more exciting. A couple of things I wish Apple would do would be maybe allow the cap end to be used as an eraser. So maybe you flip it around and based on orientation, it can add additional functionality. So almost like another gesture, erasing would make a lot of sense for a lot of apps. Also, you know, forget about, you know, and you might have to do this. If you flip it around and the cap end could be used as an eraser, maybe you want to get rid of the cap and the charging connector altogether. Right? That cap is so easy to lose. I worry about it all the time. Luckily, knock on wood, I haven't lost mine yet. But what about doing wireless charging? Apple has wireless charging in the Apple Watch. It's being rumored for the next generation iPhone. Why not have wireless charging on the Apple Pencil? They could give you a cool little tray, maybe like the ones that they use in the Apple retail stores. If you've ever demoed the pen, they have these cool white trays. Maybe that's a little charging tray. Or how about this? Maybe a charging pen case, kind of like the AirPod case, right? Where it's a battery, you slide the Apple Pencil into it, and it just has some simple contacts on the cap and gets sucked in with a magnet, and boom, you're charging. Serenity Caldwell has thought about this a little bit too. She wrote up a piece and said, what about if you just use the smart connector built right into it? And you just clicked the new Apple Pencil right onto the smart connector. It could attach. That could be the magnet mechanism, and it would charge from the battery, just draw extra power from your iPad, just like it does through the Lightning connector now, but no connector needed. So that would be pretty cool. Again, none of these rumors were in the Weibo report, But these are all things that I think we would like. And another thing that both Jeff Gamet, Serenity Caldwell mentioned, and I thought about as well, the tip on the Apple Pencil is actually removable. It's replaceable. It actually wears out. They even give you an extra tip when you buy it. What about different styles of tips? Maybe a chisel tip or a broad tip, a brush tip? I don't know. You know, the sky's maybe the limit on what they could do with different styles of tips. So interchangeable tips would be another killer new feature for an Apple Pencil 2. None of these we've heard about, but hey, Apple, take those ideas. Maybe do that in addition to just letting us clip the new Apple Pencil to our iPad with a couple magnets. So following up with that recap of what we know about the next generation of iPads, it's expected that Apple is going to release three different models. A low-cost 9.7-inch iPad. Think about that much like the current iPad Air, the 9.7-inch iPad Air. An updated 12.9-inch iPad Pro. And this new 10.5-inch iPad Pro that will, I presume, replace the current 9.7-inch iPad Pro. All three models are expected to get updated processors in the form of an A10X, and the 10.5-inch model is supposed to have a higher pixel density display and reduced bezels. So the assumption is it will be about the same size and form factor of the current 9.7-inch iPad Pro, but with a larger 10.5-inch screen. I'm not sure if the 12.9-inch iPad Pro will also get reduced bezels, but I wouldn't see why not, although we haven't really seen that in the rumors. So that's what's expected for the new iPads. New iPads in terms of when they will launch. Up until this week, it was expected that we would see the iPad Pros or the iPad updates and the new Apple Pencil sometime in March, right in line with sort of the yearly upgrade cycle. But DigiTimes, which as always is citing supply chain, claims that the iPads are still in their quote-unquote planning phases. And because of that, they don't expect new iPads to arrive until the second half of 2017. And getting away from my disappointment in hearing this rumor a little bit, because I'd like to see some new updated iPads, I think it does make sense for Apple to slow the roll a little bit of iPad releases, especially considering the recent sales trends and consumer demand for tablets, which is trailing off. I really don't need a new iPad Pro at this point. I'm very happy with my current model. I talk to a lot of people about their iPads, and most people are happy with their current model iPad. So waiting a little bit longer to do an update, I think, makes sense. It also helps build up a little more demand so that when a new product does come out, Apple's going to do a little bit better on the sales side. So that's going to be good for their bottom line. It gives them a little more time to integrate new technology. Again, Apple, take those ideas about the Apple Pencil. Let's throw those in there before the second half of 2017. So whether that means Apple will do it in the summer or fall, who knows? My guess is that it'll fall more in line with the fall release cycle of updated iPhones, although they may not want to sort of steal the thunder. So expect it to maybe be spread out over a couple different launches in the second half of 2017. But overall, I think that makes sense. And that's the latest that we know about updates for iPads. And then finally in the news for this week, a real quick one, Apple released a couple of software updates just this morning for all the things, all the iThings and the Mac things, mostly small updates fixing a lot of various security issues and addressing other minor bugs and problems. macOS 10.12.3, iOS 10.2.1, tvOS 10.1.1, and watchOS 3.1.3. So go out there, update all your stuff to their latest and greatest. One or a couple little highlights just on macOS 10.12.3. It does fix issues for graphics switching and other things that were potentially causing battery problems on those new MacBook Pros. So the new Touch Bar MacBook Pros, if you have one of those, you're definitely going to want to grab this update, especially if you've been having battery issues or if you are a user of Adobe products, specifically like Adobe Premiere. I think it addresses some stuff there that could have caused battery problems for you. 10.12.2 also has some PDF fixes in it. Although I was looking into this and not some of the PDF fixes that address the issues we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, where in some cases PDFs scanned with scanners like Fujitsu ScanSnap scanners were actually losing data. It doesn't specifically mention those as being patched. So you can try this update, but still be leery if you're using a third-party scanner like that and wanting to open those scans up in preview for editing. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to, I think, the last episode of the MacCast for the details on the PDF issues. It's either the last episode or the one right before that. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk to you about the PDF Pen family. Look, if you want to edit PDFs like a pro, then grab the PDF Pen family of apps. And what do I mean by the family of apps? Well, you can get PDF Pen for macOS, for iPad and iPhone, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. And having all of those together means that you have an entire workflow that can fit into one platform where everything is working seamlessly together with your PDFs. And one of the best things about having all those apps is being able to get that workflow across all of your devices and all of your platforms. It means that you can add text and images and signatures to your PDFs, whether you're on your Mac or you're on the go. You can mark up documents with highlighting. You can undo underscoring, strike-throughs. If you have an iPad Pro, you can even use your Apple Pencil to add your own hand-drawn markup to your PDFs, sign things. You can correct text in original PDFs with editable text blocks, fill out interactive forms and sign them, insert page numbers and specify positioning and formatting, all of these great things, and all in the same kind of familiar interface. And you can move seamlessly from iOS to Mac using Dropbox or iCloud, whatever you prefer. PDF Pen, the PDF Pen family, has that integration. And so you can make your entire workflow paperless, and you start that with PDF Pen Scan Plus. So you use that to capture your documents, receipts, either at home or on the go. That includes OCR. So you'll have access to searching and indexing those documents, all of the text and information in there. You can then move to PDF Pen on your favorite iOS device to do some editing or maybe sign a document, email that off. And then when you bring it home, you can pull it into PDF Pen for macOS, where you can do some of the advanced things like redacting text, which includes also erasing that text so it can't be searchable. It gets it out of the OCR, something a lot of other applications don't do. And you can even do things like exporting directly into Microsoft Word document formats. So if you need to do that, that's all available with PDF Pen on the Mac. And as you can see, you can move seamlessly from one app to the other, again, because they're all integrated. They're all part of the PDF Pen family. So if you want to check it all out, just see smilesoftware.com/MacCast for the details on the PDF Pen family. They've got great information, video tutorials, all kinds of cool stuff on their site. Be sure to check out Smile's blog for helpful tips and tricks and hints. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Last time on the MacCast, the topic came up and I talked a little bit about my thoughts on smaller built-in SSD and flash storage, specifically in new notebooks, but just also the general trend of moving to SSDs and how that has caused storage prices to actually kind of move up and storage sizes to get a little bit smaller in newer devices. And this was after years of having storage get larger and larger and cheaper and cheaper. And many of you had written in to discuss kind of some frustration with that, saying that, you know, I have this current MacBook, it's got a 1 or a 2 terabyte hard drive built into it. I'm looking at a new model and all I can afford is 256 gigabytes or 512 gigabytes. And so I'm going to be essentially halving or quartering the amount of storage that I actually have. And how do I deal with that when I have an ever-growing media library and an ever-growing photo library and all of these things, right? And we talked about that a little bit. And I think one of the things that I concluded there was that, yeah, it's a hassle, but there's probably not much we can do about it, at least when it comes to internal storage, other than buying, you know, as much as you can afford. You know, get the biggest and most amount of built-in flash storage that you can get, because guess what? You can't really upgrade that, at least internally, aftermarket. I conceded that the ship has already sailed in many ways, and we're going to have to find ways to just, quote-unquote, deal with it. And I also mentioned that my solution has been mainly to turn to external options until prices come down. So I buy a lot of USB external bus-powered hard drives, and that's kind of how I deal with it. And I move my libraries and larger files and documents off to those external storage solutions. But one option I didn't discuss was actually brought up by many of you. It kind of just slipped my mind. And Randy was one of those people who chimed in on this, and this is what he had to say.
Hi, Adam. A couple of comments on your recent discussion of the wimpiness of the SSDs and MacBooks, MacBook Pros. My solution has been to buy fast SSD, SDXC cards and put them in the card slot of my MacBook Pro. I get big ones, and I have one for my business and one for my media. And I use TuneSpan, which is a program that takes iTunes information and puts it out on the SDXC card, but leaves your library and all the links and so forth live. So when that card's in there, you can play it on your Mac, you know, just as if it was on your local SSD card. And the advantage of this is that the SDXC cards, of course, almost just about disappear into the body of the MacBook Pro, so I just leave them in there all the time. If you are unfortunate enough to upgrade to the new Touch Bar Mac and the new form over function, get rid of all of the ports design. There's still some solutions. Kingston makes a USB powered SDXC card holder that'll hold one full size and one mini card, so you can get some external storage that way without a big footprint. Alternatively, a medium sized footprint. I really like the Shadow Mini external SSD drives. They're about half the size of, you know, of a regular external drive. Difference being, of course, they're SSDs, and it's quicker than liquor to put stuff on them. I recently bought a 1 terabyte size one for $300. Not cheap, but on the other hand, as I say, quicker than liquor. So those are some suggestions. Thanks so much for your show. Appreciate it. Bye.
Hey, Randy. Thanks. And thanks for sending those tips and tricks in. TuneSpan, I will give a link in the show notes at maccast.com and also a link to the Shadow Mini SSD drives. But I will say, Randy, your suggestion of using an SDXC card in the card slot was mentioned by many MacCast listeners. I received a lot of emails from you saying, hey, this is how I get around this problem. And that's great. Obviously, if you have a MacBook Pro, an older MacBook Pro, that has the SD card slot. The only thing I'll say about that is it still tends to be a little bit on the pricey side, especially if you're trying to get those larger, faster SDXC cards. I did a little pricing, and it looks like you can get about a 512 SDXC card for around $200 or so. If you have an older MacBook Pro, you can also just swap out your spinning drive. This is something I did in my 2011 model with an internal SSD drive, and prices are about the same, around $200 or so for a 512 gigabyte SSD. But if you just need additional external storage, I think SD cards are a good option. The one other caveat that I'll give is while they have really fast access times, your mileage may vary in terms of data transfer rates. But for things like, you know, streaming music or videos, they're probably going to work just fine, and they're going to be faster than maybe even using an external hard drive. It really kind of depends. So you need to do a little bit of searching around and a little bit of research to determine if it's a solution that's going to work for whatever your storage plus application needs are. But definitely a good option for secondary storage. If you just want to carry around more files or documents or something like that, it's a great way to go. And they do have, you know, certain designs that'll even fit flush, like you mentioned, right into the card slot. So you can just leave it in there permanently, almost like an SSD drive, a built-in SSD drive. I know some people who will even boot off of them, although, again, performance-wise, your mileage may vary. And I also like the idea of getting and using external SSD options because they're going to have a smaller footprint maybe than the traditional external USB drives. But still there, you're going to end up paying a lot more per gigabyte. External SSDs are just about as expensive or actually a little more expensive than internal ones. Maybe not when you compare to maybe some of Apple's flash pricing when you're looking at upgrading some of their models. But you get the point, right? You're going to have to do some cost analysis. You're going to have to look at what your applications are and decide. You know, I've found, and I'll just reiterate sort of what I came, the conclusion I came to on the last episode of the MacCast, I've found that I really don't find it all that inconvenient to just have my libraries, like my photo library and my iTunes library, on external bus-powered traditional USB 2.5-inch USB drives. That works great for me. And when I need to travel, they're small enough. They fit in my bag. I know you have to take a couple extra cables. Obviously, it's not as good as having all that storage built in, but it's really not a big deal. And the drives just keep getting smaller and better performing with USB-C. I would imagine it's going to get even better as those drives become available. So I think ultimately when Apple was looking at this, you know, they just decided, you know, this is going to be okay. We're kind of in this transition phase. Obviously, flash storage SSD is becoming the norm, and that is ultimately a good thing because it means that storage sizes are going to continue to rise and pricing on that stuff is going to continue to go down as more and more people move away from traditional hard drives. So supply and, you know, classic laws of supply and demand will apply, and classic laws of technology will apply. So I think we're going to get moving in that same direction that traditional hard drives did with SSDs. It's just going to take a little bit more time. And, you know, 5 years from now, we're probably not even going to be worried about this conversation. We're probably going to have, you know, plenty of storage. Well, we never have enough storage, right? Let's be honest. But, you know, the balance of power is going to shift back, I think, ultimately. But thanks to everybody who wrote in, chimed in, and gave their thoughts on this issue. Another common email I've been getting is one related to the rumor that Apple is potentially phasing out their airport routers, and more specifically, their time capsule routers. I hadn't realized how actually popular the time capsule was until this story broke, and many of you wrote in to say, hey, that's how I do the backups. That's how I do my Time Machine backups for all my Macs. I like the network backup capabilities of the time capsule, and it's working fine for now, but what happens in, you know, a few years down the line when I can't buy a replacement? What am I going to do? What are my options? So can you talk a little bit about time capsule alternatives? And I'm in no way an expert, so I'm actually going to throw this out a little bit. You know, the reason I'm bringing this up is to throw it out to the wider MacCast community. I'd love to know if you have a network-attached backup solution and it's not a time capsule, what are you doing? I'm going to share my thoughts and ideas. Some of these I use, some of these I don't, so I'll be able to talk about a few of them in a little more detail, but I'll tell you how I handle it. So I think the most obvious would be to use some other brand of network attached storage. And there's a couple different options. You have network attached storage arrays or just network attached storage drives from various manufacturers. The one that I am most familiar with is the Synology Disk Stations, and they have a whole line of products. I happen to have a 5-bay one. I should have ran into the other room, but I didn't. I don't remember the specific model number. but it has five drive bays. I think I have three of those slots filled. And it's a traditional network attached storage solution, but it also has the ability to install different apps, set up shared folders. And one of the features that's built into the Synology software is the ability to set up a shared folder that will work for Time Machine network backups. And I have to say, I like the Synology a lot. The interface is a web interface you go through. It's okay. It's not great. It's a little on the technical side. You have to set up user accounts and you have to set up shared folders and, you know, check some check boxes and things like that. So it's certainly not a, you know, one click solution like the Time Capsule might be, but it's relatively, I would call it moderate to intermediate to set up. And once you've done it, it's pretty easy. You go into the software, you set up the folder that you want to use for your Time Machine backups. You set up a user account for Time Machine. And then when you go onto your Mac in the Time Machine settings, you choose to add a new Time Machine backup. And it should just show up as a network backup location. If it doesn't, you may have to just go into the Finder and mount it as a shared drive. And then it should show up to Time Machine. And then once you've set it up, you can back up your Macs just like you would to a standard Time Capsule. And I've done this actually with two Macs on my home network. Most of my Macs, I actually still back up via Time Machine to directly attached USB drives. But I have a MacBook Air that one of my daughters uses and an older iMac. And I just needed a Time Machine backup solution for those. And I didn't want to buy another drive. And I had the Synology available already. So I just enabled this feature. And now I have network backups for those machines. And that works great. I've had no issues with that. Something I'm less familiar with is Drobo's solution. If you have a network Drobo, like the Drobo 5N, I know they have built-in functionality for doing Time Machine backups over the network. I don't have experience with that because all of my Drobos are actually direct connected Drobos. So I have Drobos and I do backups to them, but that's all through direct connections. And I'll give you a network solution in a little bit here that's somewhat related to that, where I use a direct connected Drobo, but still back up over the network. The other sort of time capsule, what I'm calling Time Capsule alternative NAS solution would be something like Western Digital. They have their MyCloud personal NAS drives, and I think they have OneDrive and TwoDrive models. Those can be set up and used as Time Machine network drives with the latest Mac OS and the latest firmware on the drives. Again, this is a solution I haven't personally used, so if you've had experience with it and can tell us if it's good or bad, let us know, but it's certainly an option. And what I liked about this option is it looked like it was relatively inexpensive. You could pick up one of these drives, a 4 terabyte version I priced on Amazon for about $160 US. They have a 6 terabyte model that's $244 and an 8 terabyte version, single drive 8 terabyte version that's $300. So pretty cost effective if you need to do some network backup, you know, Time Machine backups. So that might be a solution that you look into. A couple of other alternatives. As I mentioned, you can do what I'm going to call roll your own solutions. So rather than just having a traditional NAS drive that you just connect, you know, to the Ethernet or to your Wi-Fi network and then begin backing up, you could do something like use ChronoSync, which is a great application from Econ Technologies. It'll allow you to direct connected backups and syncing and folder syncing. It has a ton of great features. I know I've brought it up on the show several times, but in this scenario, sort of as a Time Capsule replacement, what you probably want to look into is they have a companion product called Chrono Agent. And what Chrono Agent does is it allows you to use ChronoSync to backup and sync to a network Mac. Now, you can do this without ChronoSync using ChronoSync if you want to just turn on network file sharing and then attach the drive. But what Chrono Agent does is it allows you to kind of bypass that. And if you have a Mac that's running Chrono Agent, it will just show up in ChronoSync as an available syncing and backup location over the network. So what I, the way I use this is I have a Drobo that is connected to an old Mac Mini that I own, a really old Mac Mini. It's actually a first generation Mac Mini. I think it's running an Intel Core Duo processor. It's like a 1.6 gigahertz one, and it's maxed out. I can only run Mac OS Mountain Lion on it. I think it's at 10 iOS or Mac OS 10.6 or OS 10 10.6. Anyway, I digress. It's just an old machine, and I've got this Drobo connected to it, direct connected, and I have Chrono Agent running on it, and then I can back up my MacBook Pro over the network using ChronoSync to the Drobo. And in this case, I'm using ChronoSync selectively, so I kind of do what I call my archive backups to it, where I have things like my home folder, my web projects folder, my iTunes media library, all of those things backing up via ChronoSync to this. So I'm not really using it like a time capsule, but ChronoSync does allow you to set up in a way where you can actually save archives and versions of your files. You're not going to get the cool, you know, going back in time interface like you would with a traditional time machine or using, you know, a time capsule, but you still can go back and save versions. And if you accidentally overwrite something, still recover it. It's going to be a little bit more cumbersome with ChronoSync, but really not that bad. And you can certainly set that up. And what's great about this is you can use any existing, you know, USB drives or anything and an old Mac to set this up. You don't have to use a Drobo. I happen to use a Drobo because I like the redundant storage and the benefits that it has. But this could just as easily have, you know, some drives connected to it, or you could even back up to the internal drive on that old Mac. So this is a great repurpose of, say, an old Tower or Power Mac that you might have lying around that's really not doing anything. You could certainly set this up and use that as your network backup. And I could do this with multiple Macs or one Mac. It really doesn't matter. So that's another way to go. I guess kind of the third option, and this, again, really isn't a time capsule replacement as much as another sort of network backup solution, and not a local network backup solution, but the option would be to use a cloud backup service. It's not quite as convenient as maybe using a time capsule, but many cloud backup services like CrashPlan, which is one of my favorite ones, have file versioning as part of their backups. You could also use something like Backblaze. I'm not familiar with all of the features on all of the services, but as a CrashPlan user, you know, I have actually used their versioning to recover files that I accidentally overwrote or maybe deleted and forgot about. You know, the key feature that you're looking for, if you're looking for an alternative solution that's maybe not Time Machine, is the ability to store versions of files as you make changes or as you delete them. Again, Time Machine wraps it up in a one-click, quick, easy, slick interface, and you may or may not discover something that is as good as that, but there certainly are options out there. I guess that's the ultimate point of bringing all this up, is that you do have some options, there are some solutions, there are some ways to actually build this out. And I'm curious to hear what other solutions you've come up with to kind of recreate the, you know, time capsule, but not in a product from Apple. So if you have some feedback on this, if you have a tip or trick, certainly send those along, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to talk a little bit about something that personally for me, I'm surprised I've been using more and more. It's a feature of one of my Apple products. And when I first thought about this, I thought, oh, I'm never really going to use that. But more and more, I'm finding that I actually am. And that is a feature on my Apple Watch, sending and replying to messages. I figured, you know, I might use it when I get a message notification to see what somebody sent me, and then I'd probably pull my iPhone out of my pocket and start typing away in messages and respond. But more and more, I'm finding situations where I don't have to or don't want to take my iPhone out of my pocket, and I'm using actually the features on my Apple Watch to reply. And I think it is a testament to how easy Apple has kind of made it, at least with messages. Some of the other features of my Apple Watch, I really have a hard time being interactive with. They tend to be more one way. And I'm talking about things like calendar. Even though I use Fantastical 2, which is great, actually putting entries into the Apple Watch is not really feasible. It's not really doable. Responding to emails, I've tried that a little bit, even with using Spark on my Apple Watch. For anything other than a quick reply, it's really not viable. But with messages, Apple's made it pretty easy to interact from the Apple Watch. So I wanted to talk about some of the ways that I do that and maybe give you some hints and tips and tricks along the way if you want to try this out with your own Apple Watch. And maybe you've been leery to do it because it just seems like it'd be too tiny and too cumbersome. So what absolutely works best for me is using dictation, tapping the little mic icon, actually speaking the reply that I want to do and having that translated to text. Most of the time, if I'm in a good environment where it's not too noisy, it is pretty accurate. I've found very few issues, and you could just tap on something and quickly change it. And that is the number one way. I have changed one of my settings because you are generally given a couple different options. It'll ask you if you want to send the actual translated text or the audio, or you can actually set it to one or the other. In my case, I found that I really wanted to send the transcript or the text. So if you open up the Apple Watch app and go in the My Watch tab under Messages and then click on Dictated Messages, you'll see the options. You can change between transcript, audio, and transcript or audio, which is the one that I think is the default where it asks you. I've changed mine to just transcript. But, you know, another way, if you'd prefer just to send the straight audio and not even worry about the translation, that's another great way to go. I just don't have a lot of people that I text with that are interested in probably getting a bunch of audio files from me. But it's certainly a way to go. And that works really, really well. But the big feature that I'm finding that I'm using more and more and really didn't think I would use is what Apple calls the scribble feature. And this works great because sometimes you really can't always do audio. You know, you're in a situation where you don't want to activate the mic and speak out loud to your Apple Watch a la Dick Tracy. And Scribble is a great alternative for this. For if you don't know what this is, when you receive the message or you're replying to a message, you will see a button that says Scribble. If you tap on that, it gives you a little area on the Apple Watch where you can actually draw out the letters. You literally write on the screen. And I thought, there's no way there's going to be enough space for me to do this. But it actually works really, really well. One of the keys is to make sure that you are drawing the letters as you want them to appear, specifically upper or lowercase letters. When I'm generally writing stuff out, I prefer to use all caps. The problem is, if you do that with Scribble, you're going to be yelling at everybody. So you have to draw upper and lowercase. So if you were like me, you might have to change your behavior a little bit. But when I first started using it, the mistake I think I made and where I felt it was going to be too cumbersome was I would write a letter and I would kind of wait for it to translate that letter and display it on the screen, and I'd write the next one and then I'd write the next one. What I've learned since then is the best way to use the feature is to just start scribbling, just start writing one letter right over top of the other, you know, go as fast as you want and let autocorrect and let the system do its thing. It will catch up, so you don't have to worry. It can get a little bit hard to see what you're writing, but you know what your letter shapes look like. Just draw those letters and write it all out, and it will just sort of blurt and spit everything out. And I'm finding most of the time it gets most of the things correct. And again, for any words that are wrong, you can go back, scroll back and forth through the text, and you can actually tap on them to get suggestions and to correct them. So what happens when you tap on maybe a word that was misspelled or a word that it just didn't translate right, you tap on it, you'll get a little green box around the word, and then you can use your digital crown, you start scrolling on it, it will pop up suggestions for alternate words or alternate spellings, just like the autocorrect. It's basically accessing the autocorrect feature. And as a matter of fact, you can use autocorrect while you're using Scribble by typing maybe or writing out the first few characters of the word you want to write, and then using the digital crown to actually get the suggestion. Again, I haven't found that particularly useful. I find that it's better just to write out the whole message quickly by scribbling it and then correcting any mistakes that it might make. And that has proven to be a pretty good way. You know, I don't think I'd write a very long text message like that, but a one-sentence reply, it works great for. So I encourage you, if you haven't played around with Scribble at all, try that feature out a little bit. It's pretty nice. A couple other little handy tips to give you. If you're a big fan of emoji or stickers or the new handwritten text, there's actually a pretty easy way to access that stuff. A lot of people know if you tap on the little emoji icon that you can bring up those interactive animated emojis. If you'd prefer more traditional emoji, if you just swipe to the right, eventually you will see the standard emoji, and you can use your digital crown to scroll through all the different emoji that are available, and you can tap any one of those to add it to your message. If you swipe right again from that emoji screen, you get to a screen called Recents, and within Recents, it will show you any recent stickers that you had used on your iPhone for messages, any recent emoji that you may have used, and any recently used handwritten text, and you can actually just tap on and select those. The one thing to note about this, if you are using the stickers, is the stickers, you obviously, because of the Apple Watch interface, you can't apply those to the bubble messages. You know, you can't drag them out. They just get sent as a single message. So just be aware of that, but you can actually access those things. And unfortunately, you cannot access like the full application to get at stickers that you haven't used recently on your iOS device. But if you go onto your iOS device and use a sticker, it will then show up on and be available from that Recents menu in the Apple Watch. So that's another kind of handy feature if you're replying to messages from the watch itself. Another feature that is in messages is what Apple calls their tap backs. This is when you tap on a friend's chat bubble and you can give it a thumbs up or a heart or a ha-ha or an exclamation point, you know, those little indicators that you can add to those. You can actually add those to messages on your Apple Watch too. If you double tap on the message bubble in the conversation, it will bring up a little menu and you can tap whichever icon you want to add and it'll send that right back directly from the Apple Watch. Another convenient feature that I've used on a couple of occasions, you know, I'm texting with someone, I'm supposed to meet them somewhere or give them an address of where I'm at. You can actually send your current location from the Apple Watch. If you're in a conversation, if you force press on the screen, it'll pop up a menu and you'll see the send location option. And that will send the location to them in Apple Maps where you currently are. So if you're trying to help someone find where you're at, that's a great way to go. Also from the same menu, you'll probably notice that you get the option to access details of the people who are in the conversation. So if you need to look at the contact records of somebody who's in a conversation on the Apple Watch, you can do that from that screen as well. And also you can switch between language keyboards. So if you've gone into settings, general keyboards, and added a new keyboard, multiple languages, and you want to switch between them, you can do that from the screen. And this is handy, too, if you're going to use the Scribble feature, because then it will auto-correct correctly for whatever language you're currently texting in, and you can quickly and easily switch back and forth between your various keyboards. So there's that. And then the last little tip that I have for you, another convenient way to sort of reply and respond to messages on the Apple Watch is to use the default replies. And so Apple will kind of suggest possible replies for a message like maybe okay or I'm on the way. Some people don't realize you can actually customize those or add your own custom ones. So if you have common phrases that you would often text back or reply to different family members or friends with, you can add your own personality to those default replies. If you go into the Apple Watch, into the My Watch tab, click on Messages, and then you can tap on Default Replies. You can add, remove, or change those replies. So if you're more of a yeah person than a yes person, go ahead and change that, and it'll be personalized for you. And that way, when you're replying from your Apple Watch, people will maybe not even necessarily know that you're using your watch to do that. But with all those features kind of combined, I'm starting to learn to use them better and a little bit more. I'm getting out of the sort of mindset that, wow, I really can't do this on my Apple Watch, and more into the mindset of, yeah, actually the Apple Watch works pretty well for this. So if you haven't done that, play around with it and let me know what you think. And hopefully some of these tips help you out. If you have some additional ones that maybe I don't know about, please share those with us as well, maccast@gmail.com. MacBook.com. All right, that's going to bring us to the last thing for today, my thing of the moment. Now, this is not specifically Mac related, but it's something you can definitely use along with your Mac, and it's something that I have had a lot of fun with, especially with my kids, especially if you're in a field where you're going to be doing STEAM, science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEAM, science, technology, engineering, art, and math learning. So for you teachers, parents out there, it's a, I don't want to call this necessarily a toy, but it's a kit called Little Bits. And these are great for making the leap from code to hardware. They are magnetic, snap together little circuits. So you have these little units, and they're color-coded based on what they do. So you have little blue ones that are power units. So there's, you know, battery power unit and a USB power unit. You have pink units, little pink bits, which are inputs. So they might be buttons or switches or pressure sensors, all those sorts of things. You have orange bits, which are your wire and logic bits. So you might have XAND or OR bits, or you just have split wires or forks, those sorts of things. And then you have green bits, which are all of your outputs. So those could be something as simple as a light or some sort of display or a fan, a speaker, any of those things. And what you do is you take the bits and you combine them together to make circuits. And they can be very simple circuits. So probably one of the most simple ones, one of the first ones I made, was connect a blue power circuit to a pink input button, push button, and then to a green LED. And guess what? You push the button and the LED light lights up. So it can be as simple as that. But you can also combine them and mix and match them to get much more, you know, to get a much more complex circuit. And people are doing some amazing things with these. And they, the great thing about them is they come in little kits. You can get a starter kit, but then they keep adding and designing new bits. So they now have wireless control bits. You can do infrared. You can get an Arduino bit. So this is where the Mac might come into play. You can actually write some custom code on your Mac, download it into your Arduino bit, and integrate that into your Little Bits circuit. They have a cloud bit that will allow you to connect your Little Bits circuit to the internet, to your Wi-Fi, and you can even integrate that with services like If This Then That. So there are people taking Little Bits and using these for home automation projects. I've seen people put together bits that allow them to control their thermostat or a heater or something like that at home. So you can start to do your own custom home automation. And they now even have one of the wire logic bits is a Bluetooth low energy bit that will allow you to control your Little Bits circuit from your iPhone or your Android phone. You can get access to both inputs and outputs. So you can use your iPhone display, for example, as an output, a wireless low energy Bluetooth output. And they also have all kinds of accessories. So there's mounting arms, there's mounting plates, and they integrate really, really well with Lego. So you can build little Lego cars and build your own, you know, Lego powered projects, or you can make all kinds of mechanisms that integrate with Lego. They have motors and wheels, and I mean, it goes on and on. They're really infinite. And what's great about them is just that they're so simple because there's no wiring, there's no soldering. You just connect them together with the little magnets, and it helps avoid errors too, because you can only connect them in one way, right? They're polarized, so you're not going to make a mistake. It's almost like, you know, MagSafe connectors between these little things. And I have just had really a lot of fun with them. And behind all of this, there's a great community website that's perfect for learning and getting inspiration. If you're a teacher, they have some great lesson plans and ideas for integrating these, again, with your STEM and STEAM learning in the classroom. And as I mentioned already, they have some great starter kits that are themed. So they have like a a home automation kit. They have a basic starter kit. They have a music kit that they work together with, I believe, Korg. So if you want to make your own, you know, music synthesizer, music instrument, that's a great kit for getting going with that. And you can also just buy bits individually. About my only complaint, if this really is a complaint, you know, being an Apple fan, is they're a little on the pricey side. But they're pricey because they're really worth it. They're really well put together. They're really well thought out. And if you go to the show notes at maccast.com, I will have in there, in the entry for this show, a refer a friend link that I got that will get you $20 off your Little Bits purchase. So if you want to pick these up and you want to save $20, you can use that link and you'll get $20 off. And this is not a sponsor. They're not paying me to say this. I actually just really love this product. And the benefit of me giving you the refer a friend link is when you get your $20 off, I'm going to get $20 off my purchase as well. But they make this offer for anyone. So once you've bought some Little Bits, if you want to give your friend a 20% off purchase and get $20 for yourself, go ahead. Just go on the website and you can generate your own refer a friend link. So for this one, though, if you'll use my refer a friend link, that's great because I get $20 off my Little Bits. You get $20 off your Little Bits. And they're just really cool. I've done a couple projects. You can follow me on the online community. I think I'm MacCast on there. And it'll be great to see what you build with these things, and you can check out what I've built with them. It's really fun, and I can't believe I haven't mentioned it on the show before. So that's why this week, Little Bits are my thing of the moment. But with that, I think we are going to wrap it up. I have one last item that I have to get to, and many of you are probably waiting with bated breath for this one. If you haven't heard in the prior episodes, I have an extra set of Apple's AirPods, just because of how things worked out. And if you listen to the episode, you know how this happened. Go back and listen to my AirPod adventure, and you'll know why I have an extra set. But I have an extra set, and I thought, well, let's not just return them to the store. Let's give them away to somebody in the MacCast community. So I'm giving them away. The way this is working is there are three secret words. I'm giving out a secret word in each episode. This is the third episode I've been doing this, so you're going to get the last word today. If you missed the other two, go back and listen to the previous two episodes. But once you have all three words, I am going to set up a web page on the MacCast site. I'll give you the URL. It's going to be maccast.com/AirPods with an S, AIRPODS. I will have a form up there. Give me until Wednesday. I haven't set this up yet. So I'm recording this on Monday the 23rd. So on Wednesday the 25th, you should be able to go to maccast.com/AirPods. There'll be a simple form. Tell me the three words and then give me your email address and you will get your name in to be eligible for the giveaway of the AirPods. It's really that simple. Three words. And the final word, the final secret word for today is Q72. So I guess it's not technically a word. It's a letter and two numbers. The last two were two words. I'll give you a hint. They were 80s references in case you're having trouble remembering those. And all of these are actually some of my favorite Macs. They are the keywords. They are the code words for some of my favorite Macs. And so if you want to know what those are, maybe you can do a little research with an app like Mac Tracker and figure out what these models are. That'll be bonus. You won't get any preferential treatment for the giveaway, but if you want to tell me which model Macs were used as the secret words, you can do that as well. Just send that to me in an email, maccast@gmail.com. But use the form on Wednesday, maccast.com/AirPods, and then in February, you'll have until, pulling up a calendar now, you'll have until February 14th. Let's call it Valentine's Day. So midnight on Valentine's Day to get your name in for the giveaway. And it's really that simple. And then I will let the person know after the 14th, the lucky person who I will be sending these AirPods to. So good luck. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you're on Google Plus, you can check out our Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.